This is the seventh tape in the Marriage Growth and Preparation series sponsored by the Neighbors Who Care Paraprofessional Counseling Ministry of Neighborhood Church. The topic of this session is Physical Concerns in Marriage. The speaker is Dr. Roger Butts, MD. Dr. Butts graduated from Northwestern University Medical School in 1962. 5 years of postgraduate medical education included training in internal medicine. Prior to 1972, he served as chief of medical service at a Veterans Administration hospital. During the past 3 years, Dr. Butts has worked primarily as medical director for a large corporation. He has also been medical director of an alcoholism treatment center in a local hospital, providing consultation, patient care, and teaching. He is currently serving on the board of the Snohomish Assembly of God Church.
Okay, I want to talk with you tonight some, and then hopefully from you some questions on the subject of the physical aspect of the marriage relationship. I guess you're in the midst of, towards the end of a rather more extensive seminar experience than has been the previous format for this program. I think prior to this it was only 4 or 5 sessions, and now you've got 8 or 10, so quite a bit. And I suspect that some of what I'll have to say will overlap some of the things that have been said before, but I hope that we can limit it pretty much to the physical aspect, because I think it's a very important area that's been neglected. And I say that with mixed feelings. I think it's an area that perhaps has been neglected, but it's an area that has perhaps been overemphasized too. It depends on what your exposure has been. In our society, the aspect of sex and physical love, if you would, that's a poor word there, has been grossly overemphasized. Our society is just enthralled with sex. And we're just captivated by it, stimulated by it. And yet, on the other hand, we're dissatisfied, confused, and frustrated. Most people are very depressed about their sexual experience in life. And from a church's standpoint, the problem has often been we've been silent on the subject, or else have been totally negative in whatever we had to say about it. We've said, you can't do this, and you mustn't do that, and you've got to confine yourself to this setting. We've had a lot of negative things to say about it, but nothing really that positively addressed people's realization that they were sexual beings and needed to find an appropriate format to express themselves in that realm. It's a real problem in our country. I want to quote a couple of figures for you that I heard in a speech a couple of weeks ago. Last year in this country, there were 1 million pregnancies in women aged 15 to 19 unmarried. 1 million in this country in 1976. 325 were aborted, and 708 resulted in deliveries. So there's really only 935,000, almost a million. In this state in 1975, there were 380 pregnancies in women aged 14 and less, of which 280 were aborted and 100 babies were born in 1975 in this state to girls 14 or less. 1.7 million girls age 14 and less are sexually active in this country. 10 million women under age 20 are sexually active out of marriage. It's a real problem because 75% of teenage marriages break up within 5 years, just don't last. And so the sexual experimentation that's going on in our country is just unbelievable. And the tragedies that result in terms of child abuse and teenage parenting and the marriages that are considered necessary are really a tragedy. All right. Before I get into what I want to discuss with you, let me say that anything I have to say is based on two premises. One, that marriage is ordained of God, and when I speak of marriage, I am talking now of sexual intercourse in marriage only. And I don't want to talk about the finances or the spiritual aspects or anything else, but marriage in terms of the sexual aspect is ordained by God and is a holy union, and we'll talk about that a little more. And secondly, that sex outside of marriage is forbidden by God without any compromise or any question. It is forbidden by God outside marriage. And no matter what society we live in, or what changes we're seeing occur in our society, what trends are occurring, The Bible very specifically and explicitly forbids sex outside marriage. It is a sin. It is a sin and therefore is forgiven by God, as sins are when they are repented of. But it is nonetheless a sin, no matter what kind of candy coating it is placed in. Okay. Paul speaks of sex. Sin and sex are not synonymous words. That was a slip. In Ephesians chapter 5, and I'm sure you've been through this in some detail, but I want to point out a couple of interesting points here that I think are deserving of attention. In the last part of Ephesians chapter 5, Paul said, "Wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands as unto the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be unto their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church." Right in one sentence, he says, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church." He's drawing a simile here between the marriage relationship and Christ and the church. He says that he might sanctify the church and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself. Then in verse 28, "So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. No man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, and of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband." Those last few verses are just fascinating to me. Because in one verse he talks about marriage, and the next verse he's talking about the church, and the next verse marriage, and the next verse the church. And he alternates for about six verses there. And sometimes he doesn't even finish the sentence. He carries around on the same sentence, changing the tone from marriage to the church to marriage and the church. And clearly states that the sexual aspect of marriage, the physical union of a man and a woman in marriage, depict for us the way in which the church is a part of Christ. We are bone of his bone. We're joined to him. Now, the union of a person with Jesus Christ is a tremendous thing to think upon. A fantastic depth of spiritual truth is there, that we become one in him. And when God sees us, he no longer sees us as a person in our own glory, but we're clothed in the righteousness of Christ. And he sees us not as us, but in Christ, as a part of his Son. Right? That's a tremendous spiritual truth. And Paul says, here's an example that you can understand that better. A man and a woman come together and they become one flesh, truly one flesh. Well, that places tremendous spiritual significance on the physical relationship of marriage. That places God's blessing upon the sexual aspect of marriage in a very real way, as far as I'm concerned. I think, however, that we've got to realize that when Paul is speaking of this, he is not spiritualizing the sexual aspect of marriage to the point where he is speaking of marriage synonymously with this. And when he speaks of the cherishing and the loving that a man would give to his wife because that's how he would treat his own body, I think he's saying something here that's rather interesting. In no way is Paul suggesting that the grounds for the physical union is some kind of spiritual aspect. Nor is he saying that the grounds for a successful physical union is romantic love of some sort, which is an aberration of our generation and society. And I think that's proven by his words in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Where Paul said, "Know ye not that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of an harlot? God forbid. What, know ye not that he which is joined to an harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh, and he that is joined unto the Lord is one spirit." Using the same words, Paul says, when a man has intercourse with a prostitute, they two become one body. For, it is said, two become one flesh. Same description as in Ephesians. So it is the fact that the man and the woman have become physically one that is the grounds upon which then they build a romantic relationship, if you would. Nourishing and cherishing of the wife is because the husband has become one with her. And this is the grounds for it, not the other way around. This has tremendous practical significance, and I'll talk about that in a few moments. But I think we need to be sure that we understand that. And it is not a spiritual relationship that gives the grounds to the physical relationship, but vice versa. All right, the physical union is the central man-woman relationship of the marriage bond. Jesus said, two shall become joined together and be one flesh, and when God hath joined two together, let no man put it asunder. So the physical sexual act is clearly recognized and sanctioned by God and appears to be primary in the steps of creating of a spiritual bond in marriage. This places a high significance upon sexual intercourse, but it makes sense. Marital intercourse involves much more than just a physical commitment. It is first of all, however, and above all else, a supremely sensual and intensely physical act upon which is concentrated the utmost of the participant's personal vitality and is productive of the very epitome of purely physical excitement and satisfaction for both partners. And in this act, a man and woman become one flesh. I would like to suggest that within the confines of marriage, a man and a woman can expect to come together and seek for satisfaction of their own sexual personality, their own fulfillment of their own sexuality. A man has a right to come to the marriage expecting to have his manhood satisfied. And a woman can expect to come to her husband and hope to have her sexuality recognized and cultivated and satisfied. There is absolutely nothing degrading nor shameful nor guilty in regard to this relationship that should cause either partner of a marriage relationship to enter that relationship with anything but anticipation and enjoyment in regard to this relationship. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4, the writer of the Hebrews says that the marriage bed is undefiled, is pure, and marriage is honorable and respectable in all. Clearly stating that the marriage bed, the physical aspect of the relationship, is pure. Is undefiled, the scripture says, pure. So there's absolutely nothing about it that should be viewed as anything but a gift of God to be exploited, to be utilized, to be experienced, to be practiced, to be anticipated, and to be fully utilized to the satisfaction of both members. God approves this experience, and He approves the experience for the purpose of the pleasure and satisfaction of the partners themselves. And not simply for procreation, nor to consummate the marriage relationship in terms of a spiritual relationship, but for the relationship itself. Our culture contaminates our whole thinking about sex. And we live in a culture where romantic love and a lot of other weird ideas have developed that contaminate our ability to experience and enjoy this. Now, the church has, I think, confused the issue by some negativism and silence on the subject. But we need to begin with an understanding that the consummation of the marriage, the physical relationship, becomes the basis then upon which the marriage is defined and recognized. After all, a marriage license and a justice of the peace were not a part of the scriptural time. It is a part of our time and is recognized as socially worthwhile to define the beginning of marriage, but the physical consummation of marriage is what really defines the marriage relationship. And Paul points out here that that consummation occurs whenever a man and a woman have intercourse together. And he didn't really say anything about them being married. He said they came together and became one flesh. And when you join your body onto another, those two become one. C.S. Lewis in Screwtape Letters, I think, states rather flatly an opinion which you may or may not agree with. You remember Screwtape Letters is the letters between the devil and his soldiers. Yeah. So Screwtape, or the chief demon, is writing to his colleagues. He says, the enemy described a married couple as one flesh. He didn't say a happily married couple or a couple who married because they were in love. But you can make humans ignore that. You can also make them forget that the man they call Paul did not confine it to married couples. Mere copulation or intercourse for him makes one flesh. The truth is that wherever a man lies with a woman, there, whether they like it or not, a transcendental relation is set up between them which they must endure eternally or enjoy eternally. Okay, after enunciating this definition of the marriage relationship, I think Paul then gives us some very practical and useful guidelines to marriage in chapter 7. Verse number 3 says, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise unto the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. But I speak this by permission, and not of commandment, for I would that all men were even as myself. Okay. Paul gives us here principles that I think are just absolutely essential for a satisfactory marriage relationship. He says that the husband, neither the husband nor the wife have control over their bodies once they're married. Their bodies now, he's talking about. He says body, nothing else. But they give that body to the marriage partner for the satisfaction of that marriage partner's needs. Okay? That's total unselfishness, isn't it? It's actually giving up ownership, any rights whatsoever, and rendering that onto the marriage partner. What a revolutionary concept. Just to think that in our society, we should suggest that the wife becomes the controller of her husband's body and can demand of him the satisfaction of her sexual needs. That's a little different, isn't it, than the submissive, retiring role to which we relegated women in the sexual contact in this society. But that's what the Scripture says. And likewise, the husband can come to his wife and demand, if you would, unselfishly, but demand the satisfaction of his sexual needs. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent, and for a time. Okay, Paul says it's fraud to refuse the satisfaction of your partner's sexual needs and demands. Don't defraud you. Don't deny this satisfaction unless you agree together for a short period of time for a specific purpose. Namely, that you can spend that time in fasting and prayer. That's a little different than... I've never heard a sermon on that. I've heard fasting sermons, but not on the sexual continence for a period of time for a purpose. But it's interesting, you know. Paul suggests about the New Testament. If you read Paul's writings with the idea in mind of self-discipline, it's interesting the number of times Paul talks about things that have to do with disciplining of oneself here in the sexual area. He talks about buffeting his body and keeping it under lest he give in to temptations in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and or 10, I guess it is. And throughout the New Testament, Paul was a very disciplined person. I have a feeling that he may have been a jogger. At least he disciplined himself in many areas and suggests discipline here. But I think we've got to look at this. He says if we deny the satisfaction of our marriage partner's physical sexual needs, we're defrauding that person of something they own. Now, you'd be amazed at how often, either consciously or unconsciously, one partner in a marriage will try to punish the other one by refusing sexual contact. It may not be overt. It'll be, I've got to stay up and sew a little longer. You go ahead to bed. Now, really trying to avoid any advances that might end up in intercourse. And all kinds of little subtle things go on. It may not be quite that occult. It may be, you go sleep on the sofa. That's it. But bartering sexual favors to gain advantage in a marriage conflict is extremely common. And of course, it's entirely wrong. Practically speaking, it's the very worst kind of thing that can happen. A married couple should pledge early on in the marriage relationship that they will not allow their conflicts to get into the bedroom. There's no reason why a disagreement on all sorts of other things should have to go to bed and interfere with a satisfactory physical relationship of marriage. Where one is upset and clear on the other side of the bed with the back turned and so forth. It's just really interesting how this really so often becomes the culmination of a disagreement or a problem. And it shouldn't happen. As a matter of fact, the kind of communication and intimacy that can result from sexual contact between a husband and wife can be the grounds for resolving disagreements and problems. And if they can keep their feelings and pent up emotions about disagreements out of the bedroom, that can often be a means of contact and closeness that can repair the damage that's been done with hasty words or selfish intentions in other settings. And, for some married couples, half the fun of fighting is making up. So that should be kept separate. And Paul makes it clear that is a violation of a principle of marriage, that we don't own our own bodies. They belong to our marriage partner. He says, I speak this by permission, but not of commandment. He's not talking about this matter. He's speaking about the whole matter of being married. He gives permission to be married. He doesn't command people to be married. He'd rather they were unmarried like him because of the practical situation of the time he lived in. They were in persecution and problems, and being unencumbered by a family and the responsibilities was a real advantage at that time. And it may be in our lifetime later on too. Who knows? But nonetheless, he's not talking about this matter of giving ourselves physically to our marriage partner. That's not a matter of just permission. That's a commandment. He says, don't defraud each other. You don't have a right to control your own body. You give that to your marriage partner. Your body becomes theirs to use, if you would, to the satisfaction of their sexual needs. Total unselfishness concerning this aspect of our being. Now, that doesn't really sound like Paul, but it's a very, very practical concept. Okay, now I hope I've laid the groundwork that the marriage relationship, the physical aspect of the marriage relationship, defines the marriage as far as God's concerned, has His total blessing on it, and the sexual contact of marriage is there for the purpose of satisfying our needs, and we're commanded to give ourselves physically to our marriage partner for the satisfaction of their needs in order to avoid temptation. Okay, then how come there's so much problem? Well, let's look at how we develop our knowledge of sex and where we go with our knowledge. Every one of you in this room has a body of knowledge concerning sex. Some of you are probably married and some aren't. And the way you developed that was basically sometime when you were a small child, around the age of 3 or maybe a little before, you asked your first sexually loaded question. You asked your parents, where did I come from? Okay, in some form or another. Every child asks that question, not perhaps in exactly those same words, but sometimes in exactly those same words. And as a matter of fact, you ask that question in one form or another, where did I come from? And if you're going to have children, they're going to ask that question, and they're going to ask it of you first. Because in that age, you're the main contact they have. And they're going to say, where did I come from? Okay. Now, it's just very interesting the response that kids get to that question. It's a variety of answers that would stagger the imagination. I think more in our age than a few decades ago, they're likely to get a straightforward answer. But a couple of decades ago, and today, in some families, they're not going to get any kind of an answer. They're going to get either turned off and given no answer or given a lie of some sort. And I don't understand this, frankly. It seems simple enough that parents could be able to answer that question. And what you owe your child and what you were owed and whether or not you got it, I don't know, was a straightforward answer from your parents. And you should prepare yourself to give that kind of answer when you have your first child and he comes up with that question at the most unexpected moment. Where did I come from? Well, God prepares a place in mama's body, in the lower part of the abdomen, where babies are formed. And all babies come from that source. That's usually all a child needs, and that's all he wants. But he doesn't want to hear about black bags and storks and things because he's going to check on you, and he's going to ask the other parent or the neighbor lady or somebody and find out if you're telling the truth. He may not check on you if you're very relaxed and comfortable in the way you give the answer. But if he senses that, he's touched a sensitive area, and kids can tell that faster than adults. They can tell almost immediately if they've touched on an area that you're uncomfortable with. They have tremendous perception for nonverbal communication. Kids are the greatest. And if you're uncomfortable, if they've made you uncomfortable, they'll know it, and they're going to pursue that question. They'll go ask somebody else, and they'll come back to you. So be prepared for a totally comfortable answer and just anatomically explain where babies come from. Very briefly, for a child of 3, he doesn't want a lesson in anatomy, or he doesn't want to be referred to the encyclopedia, you know. Just wants to know where he came from. Did he come from a seed or an egg or what? And that's all he wants to know. It's amazing how many parents can't give that answer. And as soon as they show to the child, number one, that they won't tell him the truth, the child will find that out. Or number two, that that's an area that's a no-no. You shouldn't be asking mother and daddy that because we're uncomfortable with that. You've turned them off. You know, you're never really going to be able to communicate adequately with kids in that area. And a lot of children are turned off at age 3, and they never are able to have a comfortable feeling themselves about sex the rest of their lives, virtually, or certainly in discussion with their parents. And it's from that area that a lot of the guilt and shame and very unhealthy attitudes towards sex begin and are fostered and develop, particularly in Christian, in strict Orthodox Christian circles, evangelical Christian circles, that really can hamper or destroy the possibility of a satisfactory sexual relationship in marriage. It can be traced all the way back. The second question that comes, if the child has been given a straightforward, simple answer and knows where to come the next time he has a question, is a year or two later, generally, average. I've got 5 kids, and I would say it was about a year later. In one form or another, well, how'd I get out of there? Okay, if that's where I was formed. And again, a simple anatomical answer. There's an opening between mama's legs in her private area. God prepares at the time the baby's ready and the baby comes out. It's usually done in a hospital, and a doctor may help just to be sure there are no problems with the new baby. That's all a kid wants to know. But if you're uncomfortable with telling them that, then you've got a problem. And you'll just further destroy the possibility of effective communications and teaching that child that he can exercise his knowledge, his curiosity in the sexual area without destroying his parents, without doing something bad, okay? Which a lot of kids get communicated. The third question that all kids ask, and usually it's just these 3 things that all kids want to know until they reach the age when their bodies start to change and they become adults themselves, is how did I get in there? And it's interesting how seldom that question is asked, only because the first 2 haven't been handled satisfactorily by the parents. But again, the child wants a simple answer. Usually this occurs about age 6 or so, and he may be getting answers from various sources at school and other places by that time. So you should be comfortable, and the 2 of you agree as to how you're going to answer this, but the best way is simply to say, God has prepared men and women in such a way that a husband and a wife, a mommy and a daddy, come together in love, and as a result of coming together in love, a baby is formed inside of mother's body. Right, that's usually all the child will want to know, and if they begin to probe for details and pictures and so forth, one can point out that love is of some sorts, is a very private sort of thing. Mother and father don't kiss each other in the Safeway store because it's a private kind of thing. And that particular kind of love that mommies and daddies have together alone is very private, and they can't see that. You can't draw them a picture of that. All right. That may seem rather simplistic, but if you can say that comfortably, prepare yourself in advance for how much detail you're going to give and how you're going to say it so that when they compare answers between the mother and the father, it's consistent. You can have the door open. Now, you know, I'm a physician. My wife is a nurse. We've got 5 kids ranging in age now from almost 16 down to 8. And we've been through all these. And that's all we've done. You know, we have not gone into lengthy anatomical discussions until the kids were old enough. The girls started having their monthly periods, and my boy's old enough now that he's developing into manhood. Now we've had to have some more detailed sessions with them. But I'm happy to say that they have come to us, my wife, the girls, and my son to me, and said, Dad, I've got some questions, and I need some answers, and I know you can help me. What's going on with me? And we can sit down then and go into some considerable detail. They're old enough now that I'll tell them anything I know, which may not be too much in some of the questions they have, but it's seemingly adequate. But one has to prepare the stage for that, and I want to emphasize this. Probably 90% of you here did not have the opportunity to have good, healthy discussions with your parents about the feelings of the sexual feelings, the emotional aspects, as you developed into adulthood, and how to handle and how to seek satisfaction for the strong sexual drives that you found developing in yourselves, in which the church and your conscience sort of negated for you. You probably 90% of you did not have a good basis upon which to discuss this in detail and candidly with your appropriate parent, because they didn't handle those first questions correctly, and you found them to be either unwilling or unable to handle the questions that you had to offer them. Okay, so children in the preschool age and up to the first grade or so have these 3 questions that they want answered, and generally then they go into kind of a dormant stage for 4 or 5 years. Boys hate girls, and girls hate boys, and you know, through the preteen years, they just want nothing to do with each other, and they don't want to know anything more about anything until they then reach puberty and begin to develop sexually and find these feelings toward the opposite sex and interest and curiosity developing. Then they need more information, and they will seek those answers either through their parents or through reference material you can give them, or they'll get it from their classmates and other sources that may not have the same moral values and standards that you want to place upon it. And so if you've prepared them properly, they'll come to you and you can place this in the proper moral setting. If not, then you've got more of a problem. So it's from that background that you've come. I don't know how you got answers to your questions, and I hope that maybe we can answer some more of them here. But by the time you've reached your stage of maturity and development, those of you who are contemplating marriage and are college students, I'm sure you have done considerable investigation and hopefully feel pretty comfortable with your knowledge of the physical aspect of marriage. But more important, and by far more important, are emotionally satisfied with your handling of your own sexual feelings and drives, and have dissipated the guilt and shame and concern that may have been instilled in you, either consciously or unconsciously, by the information you gained beforehand, so that you can face the sexual aspect of marriage with a very open, candid, anticipatory, excited feeling. I hope that's the case, because that's the way it should be. And that by no means detracts from the spiritual significance nor the holiness of the relationship. And I hope that you are able to seek total satisfaction of your sexual needs in the marriage relationship. Now, let's get into some more practical details. I think you've got a bibliography that's been handed out with a series of books and other items that are available. The book by Hastings, A Doctor Speaks on Marriage, is a paperback that's readily available and will go into physical techniques of marriage relationship. And I'm not comfortable with standing up here and talking about the various physical techniques of consummating sexual intercourse. I think it's better that you read that from a manual. And I understand the tapes by Dr. Wheat on, I don't even remember the name of them, that are available in the college library or the library here, I've forgotten which, are also very good on that aspect of it. I think that in preparation for marriage, you should go get a physical examination by a physician that you can talk to, woman or man. I think you should do that. Okay, the one on the bottom, Ed Wheat, Sex Problems and Sex Techniques in Marriage, 3-hour cassettes. And then the one by Hastings, A Doctor Speaks on Sexual Expression in Marriage. That's a small paperback book that's readily available and is a good one. Now, several of the others shown here are good, but many of them speak of the spiritual aspect and the scriptural aspects and are not specifically involved with the physical technique, and I think these two would be good for that particular aspect. All right, I think you should have a physical examination done. Women should particularly have a physical examination done to be sure that the vaginal opening is not closed off or inadequate by reason of an intact hymen. Many women who use internal monthly hygiene technique don't have that problem because the hymen becomes stretched and the opening of the vaginal tract is adequate by the time marriage takes place. But occasionally, the physical act of marriage cannot be consummated because the opening to the vagina simply isn't satisfactory, and that can be easily handled as an outpatient with one visit to the doctor with a little nick to open it and be sure that it's adequate. So you should have that taken care of. Girls, if you have used internal means of monthly hygiene, or if you have had sexual intercourse prior to marriage, and perhaps not with the person that you're going to marry, you need not be concerned that you will be found out on the wedding night, or that your husband will doubt your virginity because the vaginal opening is rather stretched as a result of using internal hygiene. Men are absolutely ignorant about what size the vaginal opening should be, and they won't have your husband won't have the slightest idea as a result of consummating the physical act whether you are a virgin or not, or whether, you know, or doubt you because of anything like this. So forget it. If you're worried or concerned about this, don't worry about it. Some women who have had sexual intercourse prior to marriage feel that they probably will be found out at the time the marriage is consummated, and therefore they make a confession to their husband, which they might not otherwise do if they weren't worried about this. So don't worry about it, okay? I personally do not believe that it is a good idea to announce to your bride-to-be or groom-to-be all of your previous activities. If you have had sexual intercourse prior to marriage and you have repented of that as a sin and been forgiven by God, I do not believe you have any obligation to tell that to your partner-to-be. As a matter of fact, it often is a serious problem. And the first time a conflict occurs in the marriage, and they are bound to occur, and very soon, and frequently, those things will come out of the closet and haunt you. And they may haunt you for a lifetime. And it's better sometimes to keep that to yourself. If you need to share it with someone else, don't necessarily share it with that one who seems to be so understanding and just accepts anything from you because he or she is in love with you, and therefore you can trust them with whatever you want to lay on. No way. Forget it. Some things are better kept to yourself forever. So, okay, if that's been your experience and you prefer not to share that, I encourage you to perhaps get some counseling on that subject with a pastor or someone. But don't necessarily point this out, and you need have no fear that it will be found out, because it just won't. Right? So a physical examination, I think, is worthwhile, particularly for women, to be sure that the vaginal tract, the genital area, is anatomically normal and capable of the marriage relationship. And for men also, physical examination is worthwhile. I don't want to overemphasize this, because as a matter of fact, a very small percentage of problems in accomplishing a satisfactory sexual relationship in marriage are physical. Very small percentage. In terms of a man's inability, either impotence, inability to obtain an erection or ejaculation, or an inability to be satisfied with the relationship, fewer than 5% are physical. Of men who simply cannot consummate satisfactory intercourse, cannot, fewer than 5% are on a physical basis. In other words, the machinery is all fine. It just won't work, and it's an emotional problem. And in the case of women, in the case of frigidity or dyspareunia, pain with intercourse, and an inability to achieve a sexual climax, fewer than 10% of those are on a physical basis. Almost always it's an emotional thing. Right? I think one has to be realistic in the expectations. A man is much more forward and direct in his sexual needs and is able to achieve sexual satisfaction in a matter of a few minutes on the first occasion of sexual intercourse. It may take weeks or months or even years for a woman to learn how to achieve total sexual satisfaction in a marriage relationship and actually reach the point of an orgasm or a climax physically. It may not happen in the first year of marriage or even longer, but that shouldn't be a great problem. The desire and need for sexual intercourse, sexual experience between men and women varies a great deal. A man is at the peak of his interest and vitality in his early 20s, and then his interest and need for sexual intercourse begins to trail off gradually throughout the rest of his life. Women are only coming into the peak of their sexual experience, their sexual desire, in the late 30s, around 40 years of age, and then they plateau and drop off later in life. So there's a difference in the pattern throughout a lifetime of the needs. So it shouldn't concern you as a woman if during the first couple of years of marriage you don't find yourself totally sexually satisfied. As long as you're learning and gaining ground on the situation, you should be satisfied with that. And here's where I think Paul's admonition that we don't own our own bodies, but we give them to our partner. Total unselfishness, I think, is very important. The man needs a good deal of sexual attention when he's younger, in the first years of marriage. And a woman's needs will increase with time, even though the man's interest will decrease. So it requires some discipline and unselfishness on the part of a husband to be aware that his wife's needs are going to be continually increasing, even though his own interests may be decreasing. And he's going to have to discipline himself to meet her needs and prepare himself to be unselfish with his time and his attentions and the things that he may be more interested in, you know, 15 years later in a marriage, when his wife is more interested in sexual intercourse than she was earlier. So that's pretty important. So the attitudes have more to do with the accomplishment of a satisfactory physical contact than does the physical makeup of the body itself. I think that's really important to remember. A doctor is unlikely to be able to help once it's been established that the normal anatomy is present and there's a problem occurring. And it more likely can be resolved with counseling and communication within the marriage relationship.